The hour of 8:30 having arrived, I'll call to order state and local government operations for reform, technology, and elections. Representative Nelson, do you have a motion for us?
Yeah, I'd like to move the committee report from the local government division.
Representative Nelson moves the adoption of the division report. We, at this point, don't have a quorum, so we'll act on that once we do have a quorum. However, I believe that is House File 305. Representative Kalin, and Representative Kalin is here. So Representative Kalin, why don't you start to describe your bill? I believe there were some changes in the division. So Representative Kalin was still on the division report, and we'll act on that, and then we'll act on your motion once we have a quorum. So Representative Kalin, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In very brief, House File 305 expands on the existing enabling statute that we have in law related to transfer development rights, also known as transfer development credits. It is in essence the right to develop your land and to plant an individual unit. The right to sell that unit has been in statute for a while. Chisago County, I believe, is the only county today that has a transfer development rights ordinance. One hindrance to a robust transfer development rights market to allow landowners to be allow a willing landowner to find a willing seller or a willing buyer, for that development right is the time pressures during which a landowner might need the cash for health or other reasons, and a developer might have a narrow window to add units to a plat that's being drawn up and being proposed for subdivision elsewhere in the receiving area of the county. I know we'll have some discussion, Mr. Chair, about this, the what transfer development credits and rights are and the relationship of an exchange or a bank to those rights or credits. What I'd like to do, Mr. Chair, is just describe the amendment that was added in the division. The bill is introduced merely enables and authorizes the county to adopt by ordinance a transfer development credits bank or exchange. The amendment that we put on after working with the Builders Association, we wanted to make sure that having a third-party bank involved or enabled by a county zoning ordinance would not preclude direct two-party willing buyer, direct to willing, willing seller, direct to willing buyer transaction.
Representative Kalin, you want to direct this to the language in the bill that was amended in division as long as you're speaking to it?
Happily. It's a sentence added starting on line 2.8, and the which covers the county portion of statute and the municipality, which does include township. In our definition of municipality, begins on line 2.34. In essence, Mr. Chair, the county or municipality ordinance may not preclude private contracts between individuals or private business entities for the purchase, holding, and sale of development credits. That's the new language.
Representative Kalin, we have a quorum, so let's act on Representative Nelson's motion to adopt the committee report on House File 305. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The committee report is adopted. Representative Kalin, you have a motion on your bill?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 305 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register.
All right. That's the motion before us, members, and we'll act on that once we're done with discussion and or any further amendments, which I hope there aren't any because I'm sure this bill was well vetted in division. Representative Kalin.
It was, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for your time, and Mr. Chair and members. I'd like to quickly describe what a transfer development credit is and how it how a landowner gains that credit or that right. As you know, the density or minimum lot size of our zoning ordinances are set at the county level in our comprehensive plan. I'll speak about Chisago County because that's where this where the transfer development credits program is currently up and running, and that's the initiative for bringing the bill. And the testifiers who have helped on the bill were here for division on Monday. But Senator Klobuchar is holding a town hall meeting on an industrial park that we're working on in Chisago County today at 10, and so they're unable to make it this morning. The zoning ordinance in Chisago County establishes a 5-acre minimum lot size. So for a hypothetical 100 acres that Representative Lanning might own in Chisago County, because that you can develop one home for every 5 acres, that 100 acres allows you to develop the right to develop 20 units, 20 homes on 100 acres. We normally don't talk about the right to develop or development rights because it's implicit in our rights as landowners. However, if Representative Lanning should need cash for some reason, then he has a few options. Those options are and desires to do something other than develop land. And all the land. I think that what we're seeing is that developers, even during the boom, it's cost effective to only develop the whole 100 acres and not do it in little pieces. It's also not good planning. You could sell us our conservation easement, you could sell the land outright and place a covenant on the land, a non-development covenant, could develop the land himself, sell it to a developer, or could transfer development credits to a willing buyer who could then use those credits to increase the density. I might be able to use those credits to increase the density on my 100 acres elsewhere in the county, so that if I were to buy 10 of Representative Lanning's credits, I would then have 30 credits on my 100 acres and be able to actually increase the density. It's a voluntary program and entirely based on a willing seller and a willing buyer. The challenge is the time crunch for financial resources is often brought on by health crises or by economic crises, as we've seen in the last year or two. The time as a developer that I can sit on the earnest money and the investment I have in a property and have the plat designed and engineered and go through the process is so difficult. I might have 6 to 12 weeks during which I have the flexibility to add more units to my development, and the seller might have just a few short weeks or months to find the cash to deal with a health crisis or other family situation. It's a little bit like trying to walk into a high school gymnasium deaf, blind, and mute, and having to make a complex property transaction within a very, very short period of time. However, if the seller can sell, as happens in 4 jurisdictions around the country, can sell that development credit to a bank or an exchange that would be able to buy, hold, and then resell that credit, that would allow the seller an opportunity to find a buyer that is more stable and doesn't have the time pressures of the development. Then as a developer, I can go to the exchange or the bank, ask what credits are available, and then purchase credits from that bank. It is an existing model in 4 areas around the country. Those 4 banks are run by public agencies. What has been clear is Chisago County being understaffed and overworked for years in our zoning department isn't necessarily interested in running the development credit bank or exchange. The language, I'll just direct you to the language on lines 2.4, line 2.4 allows the county board to designate as the county's transfer development credits bank, either a nonprofit or non-governmental entity, either a nonprofit, a credit union, or a privately held commercial bank, any private commercial enterprise. I think we have an opportunity here to allow a different kind of market-based model to succeed in enabling the transfer development credits. That's the bill, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kalin, we have a question from Representative Emmer.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kalin, staying away from the deaf, dumb, and mute, and the other issues that you brought up, the emotional stuff. I'm interested to know how come we can't handle this the way we currently do through purchase of development options. Because if I'm not mistaken, if you have a willing seller and a willing buyer, there's all kinds of different arrangements that they can make privately in terms of buying or selling options to develop property, as you're talking about. So could you explain to me why this makes it better? Because I'm a little confused as to why the municipal entities want to get into the banking business, because that's what it sounds like. Maybe you can clear that up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer. The option, and I might, as I understand it, the option is the option to develop a particular parcel. What we're talking about is a landowner selling their development right as a development credit, and that being transferred either through a two-party transaction or through a credit exchange to a second parcel that would not be, that is, you have two different land owners. The owners of the land stay the same, but the development credit is then moved from one parcel to another parcel.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Emmer.
And thank you, Representative Kalin, because that does help. But I believe we can do that right now under the way the law exists. For instance, if you're doing, if you're platting developments, you already can go to the municipal authority and say, for instance, I've got a proposal here, here's the density, these are the wetland issues that I have. I want to make those up. I'm willing to, on this development in a different part of the city, I'm willing to make this up over here, have greater open spaces, how about open spaces, etc. And there's a trade-off that you do. You have the private party transaction, but then there's a trade-off you do with the municipal planning authority and ultimately the governing authority, if that's a council or... can't you already do that?
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, I believe that that the sticking point that in the instance that you're describing is the density is limited by minimum lot size or by the, for instance, that one unit, one home and 5 acre density that exists in Chicago County. I know an over Canty County Representative Eastern District is 120. That density can only be increased through a conditional use permit or a CUD or other regulatory change. This is a market-based ability to increase density and also preserve open space in the sending area and increase density in the receiving area. The main notion that drives this idea is that if we value land for its scenic or cultural or other pieces, that we should provide opportunities to actually value that land for landowners to not have to have an opportunity to increase their return on investment because they hold fine property. This allows them to do so by selling a development credit while still keeping land open.
Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Kayla. I'm sure some others have some questions along these lines. Maybe they don't, but the gentleman sitting next to me was a mayor of a city for a while. I sat on two city councils that had serious development pressure. I'll tell you that I think this is already available because I'll give you an example. The City of Independence enacted an ordinance to allow cluster development. Cluster developments with the idea that the city is determining how it's going to plan its own development, which is what you're suggesting this would help with, but then the city allowed or had flexibility to work with parties when they came in, you know, and farmers, the people that hold the land for farming, this is their retirement account in many cases, and they're planning ahead with for their future already, and they're working with private parties to come up with arrangements that work for them financially. I think you can already do this. And my biggest concern is you're creating a separate a bankable or banking industry that's based on these development credits. And I'm confused because it's not clear. I'm confused as to how the ultimate bank would be set up. Who'd be supervising the bank? Who'd be controlling the rates? Who'd be controlling, you know, when you have a sale and you have costs associated with that sale? Who'd be benefiting? Who'd be, I mean, there's just all kinds of questions. And I guess I'm wondering, you say it's in four other jurisdictions. I know that there are some banks already in place. Do you have any information for us that would tell us how those transactions, you know, who's making money off of them and how they're charged? And then lastly, and I'll leave it to some others who have some questions, could you tell me where the League of Minnesota Counties, the League of Minnesota Cities, where are they at with your proposal?
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, to the latter question, I think they're in the room, and so rather than me try to speak for them, we could ask them to come to the table and briefly state their position on the bill.
Well, Representative Kalin, there were some questions that preceded that, so why don't we get those questions taken care of, and then we can have the individuals come up. So, Representative Kalin, you want to answer Representative Emmer's earlier question?
The earlier question was about cluster development or about the I think the questions you asked, Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, about the markup and the kind of consumer protection issues, I think those are good questions, and I'm happy to speak with Chair Atkins about whether he'd like to see this in the Commerce Committee, because I think that we do need to have those.
Well, Representative Kalin, your motion is not to send it to Commerce. Your motion is to send it to the floor. So do you wish to withdraw your motion and make another one?
Well, it can always be recalled from the floor if they're acting to see it.
That's not my question. It's in this committee now. And if we're sending a bill to the floor to then send it to another committee, I have some questions for you.
Okay.
That I won't ask now.
Mr. Chair, I am happy to amend my motion.
Why don't you withdraw your first motion?
Okay, I will withdraw my first motion. I will then move House File 305 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Commerce.
All right. So that's the motion before. Then I believe Representative Emmer wanted, it was the either the League of Cities, the Coalition of Minnesota Cities, or the Association of Minnesota Counties, if any of those entities are here, why don't they come up and... Representative Lanny.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question I was going to raise is one that I'd like to hear addressed by the city and township people as well. So do you want me to ask it now or later?
Representative Lanny, why don't you pose it now, and then they can answer that one along with the other. So go ahead.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And let me say, first of all, I appreciate Representative Kalin giving an example of how this might work, but please be assured I don't own any land in Chicago County. My question is this. Representative Kalin, and I would like the representatives from local units of government to respond to this. What happens under this language if there's a disagreement between either the city or the township and the county over this kind of an issue? What happens? I mean, counties are given the opportunity under this language to establish an ordinance that sets these up. What happens if, in doing so, they change the density that, as an example, where the township disagrees or the city disagrees? What happens then?
All right, welcome to the committee, and then if each of you would identify yourself for the record before you speak. And I believe there are really two questions. One is Representative Lanning's, and the other is Representative Emmer's, dealing with the bill itself, so if you could answer both. So, welcome to the committee.
Good morning. Kent Sewell with the Minnesota Association of Townships. And I'll start, if you don't mind, with Representative Emmer's question, and I think it feeds into answering Representative Lanning's. And our association doesn't have a formal position on this bill. It wasn't one that originated through our association, but upon looking at it and discussing it with our colleagues and whatnot, we took the position that we see it as just one more tool. It's neither good nor bad. It's just one more potential asset that's there. and so we have no objections to this bill moving forward. In terms of the conflict situation, under existing law, and this would just be an expansion to the existing law, the originating TDR process has to be set up by ordinance. The county would have to have an ordinance, and then the township, under existing zoning law, has to be consistent with or more restrictive than the county. And so if a county felt that we were being inconsistent, if the township were to try to set up a TDR bank that the county felt was inconsistent, they'd bring an action in court. Hopefully they'd call the township first and try to negotiate it and resolve it. But if it became a major battle that they were saying that somehow we were undermining the county's zoning, it then would end up in a district court if the two entities could not resolve it, because we have to be consistent with the county's ordinance under a provision in 394. The cities have complete autonomy. They don't have control over a township, so if a city has a situation where they have zoning authority, they have autonomy, so it wouldn't be a matter of being in conflict with the county, or township may not appreciate it, but under existing law, we have no right or no authority to intervene in that situation, nor do they have the authority, except in some very limited situations, to come in and try to control or oppose what the township and county are doing.
Resident Emmer, to this point.
Yeah, Mr. Solem, thank you, Mr. Chair. There, as you know, there's been incredible tension over the past few years in development counties, where between townships and cities, statutory cities, and the tension arises in that the cities get the upper hand in determining how they're going to grow. And when I say the upper hand, a resident of a township can apply to get into the city, and the city gets to do that if they deem it appropriate, regardless of how the township may feel. If this is enacted, if you have this type of marketable development credit, what's going to stop the situation from arising where a township literally has to buy back development credits in order to protect its own existence or how it wants to develop?
Mr. Song.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, I believe what you're addressing is that if you suddenly have an area of very dense development, that obviously becomes a target for annexation. If a TDR program is set up well, and of course that's always an issue under existing law, under anything with this bank, the idea is that you would end up having a clustered development, a more densely developed area. Hopefully the entity, whether it's the county or the township or doing the zoning, is accounting for the necessary infrastructure to accommodate that development and growth. I mean, that's what we want them all doing. And then if there is a perceived need for annexation, it would be of a tighter, more densely compact area versus looking to take further and further into the township in order to get to where the haphazard development is occurring. So if it's done correctly, and I know that's always the key to any zoning, this actually should minimize massive land grab. It could lead to some smaller annexations, but it should be, if it's done correctly, a tighter, truly densified development. And even then, under annexation law, if the township or county are providing the adequate services, that land is no longer eligible for annexation. So it is always the key of how it's administered, but that's true under existing law.
Okay. Representative Lanning, does that begin the first answer to your question? We'll move to the others, but is that what you were looking for?
Well, yes, I'd like to hear from the others.
Everybody. Okay, next please.
My name is Annalie Garlitz, and I'm with the Association of Minnesota Counties.
You can just speak a little closer to the
microphone. I'm Annalie Garlitz, and I'm with the Association of Minnesota Counties. The first question that was asked is what do we think about this bill. This bill actually gives counties the opportunity, gives us some flexibility and an option for something to use. Mr. Sulem said, it is a tool for that would be made available for local units of government. In terms of conflict, I guess I would also agree with what Mr. Sulem said, which is that each entity would have their own ordinance, and we would do the transfer of development credits within the area that's governed by that particular ordinance. So I don't necessarily know if there would be any conflict. I don't. see that there should be or that there would be, but that's my...
All right, Ms. Garlickson, are you for the bill or against it or neutral?
We would be for this bill.
And you did not testify in division? You did not testify in the local government division?
No, I did not.
All right, and Mr. Solomon, you did not testify in the local government division?
Mr. Chair, no, I apologize. We thought the word had already reached Representative Galen that we had no opposition. Apparently that did not happen, so we were tied with another committee.
All right. Next. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Craig Johnson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. Won't repeat what the others have said. I'm in agreement with it. I would simply point out that under current statute, there's a requirement that a city have an ordinance in place to set up a purchase of development rights. This doesn't change that. It just allows one of the functions of that ordinance to include setting up a different fiscal agent other than city staff serving in that role. So for that reason, we actually think this is a flexible tool that would help some communities be able to handle this kind of a program more readily and without the drain on local staff. As far as conflicts, I think most of those would have to come up when the ordinance itself was being debated before there was any purchase of development rights. So if there was a problem with an ordinance that was grossly out of line with other requirements, it would be noted at that point as the ordinance was being adopted. Cities do have a lot of authority to have different ordinances than a county that the townships don't enjoy. But generally speaking, if a city decides to do land use planning or zoning in a certain manner, the county doesn't get a lot of say over that as long as it's within their jurisdiction. So.
All right. And Mr. Johnson, did you testify in local government?
Mr. Chair, we did not. I was with these two people over in the Senate for a hearing last night. We did not come back over in time.
If I could just make a suggestion, we're on a shakedown cruise here having a division. So I would hope that all of the local government entities would, whenever possible, make it clear to the author and to the chair of the division where you might be on a bill so we don't have to repeat, or worse, start testimony in the full committee. That would be very helpful to the author, to the chair, and to this committee. So, Representative Lang, does that answer your question? You want to follow up on
yes,
that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it does. I still have some concern about potential conflict down the road here, and we don't need anything more to bring about conflict between local units of government. We have enough of that already in some arenas.
Representative Winkler, did you get your question answered? I do have another question.
Mr. Chair, I don't know that I have another question, but I have a question for Representative Kalin, which is, do you think that there's a need for the Commerce Department to provide some oversight over these, the banks or exchanges or whatever it is that you're creating here? I'm just concerned that these institutions have a fairly tight regulatory environment, both nationally and locally, in the state, and we're kind of throwing a wild card in there. And my suggestion would be that you, before going to Commerce, you try to sort that issue out to see what kind of additional oversight might be necessary.
Representative Kalin, and I believe he did say before you go to Commerce, and Representative Atkins, I'm sure, would be very pleased if before you went to Commerce, that was resolved.
Mr. Chair and Representative Winkler, the Senate author as well, Senator Olsen, and I are starting that very conversation, and we will come to a conclusion, hopefully a final one, if not a temporary one, before we get to the Commerce, or a provisional one, I should say, before we get to the Commerce Committee.
Right. Representative Gutwall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin, this is intriguing to me. I served on the City Council for 9 years, and we went through a lot of land use things, including the annexation issues and cities wanting to incorporate on our borders and things like that. But this is a unique model. I'm trying to understand it a little bit better and have some concerns. I appreciate Representative Winkler's comments and Representative Lanning's. You can have a nonprofit act as this bank, correct?
Representative Kalin.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Right.
Mr. Chair, if you had a nonprofit, let's say hypothetically here, you buy $1,000 worth of land credit from a farmer, and the nonprofit is hanging on to that $1,000, and that grows to $5,000, $9,000. Who keeps the difference? When they sell that, you know, what are done with the profits, if you will, within that transaction? how are those regulated? And is there a potential for conflict of interest in that situation?
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwaltz, I think your questions about markup and are precisely the questions I think we need to answer related to the commerce and regulatory issues. And we could probably talk for 4 or 5 hours about that very piece. I'd like to talk to you more deeply offline to figure out how we can address some of those concerns. I do think that that a reasonable cap on markup is probably okay, but we do have to recognize that there may be some degree of speculation involved in being a purchaser and holder of those credits, and so we don't want to cut off the market mechanism at its knees by capping it too much, but at the same time I think that's an important concern. I do want to make sure that we're clear that you're buying the right to develop a single unit, and I will resist any effort to securitize and divide up those credits, that it must remain as a whole credit and held by the bank. You asked about, as well, the conflict of interest opportunity. It is a willing buyer, willing seller, even if it's the exchange is the willing buyer, rather than the third party willing buyer rather than the land to landowner to landowner or landowner to developer, that still needs to be a willing transaction. And while not the preferred motivation for adopting a CDs for purchasing development credits, I do think just as you could purchase a conservation easement, as long as there's a willing seller and willing buyer, you could also purchase and hold and not then resell development credits. It would still be money. The effect on the land, on the selling landowner, would be the same, which is a positive net cash in having vacated some of the rights to develop. The question would be, then, do you have a decrease in the total potential units developed within the county? The answer would probably be yes. I don't see a conflict of interest arising, provided that it's an arm's length, fully informed, willing transaction.
Representative Gottwaltz.
Well, Mr. Chair, just a comment. I think Representative Kalin is correct that these issues need to be dealt with, and I think they're rather important. I think these details need to be worked out, and what happens with the profit is more of an issue. You know, if you're going to make money and you're going to keep that within the nonprofit, how does the nonprofit deal with that money? Is that, you mentioned a cap, that may be one approach to it, but these are details that really need to be fleshed out more, I think, before we move to this kind of model. And I don't know if from the other four areas that have done this, the four jurisdictions you mentioned, whether they have some direction that you could take from those models. But these details would be very concerning to me as far as this bill moving forward.
Representative Gabal, it is going to Commerce, so hopefully they'll be worked out there. Representative Biscuit.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'll apologize in advance for not asking this question in division, which I sit on, but it occurred to me between then and now. Representative Kalin, we in the metro area have another level of pseudo-government, a wonderful level that the rest of the state doesn't get to participate in, and it's called the Metropolitan Council. Representative Kalin, with the Metropolitan Council having authority over the comp plans and regulation over the comp plans, I'm just wondering, and maybe it hasn't occurred to you either, so you're going to have to find out, would any proposed transfer of development credit have to be approved by the Metropolitan Council prior to it becoming legal?
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Biskins, I don't know the answer to that question. I can find it out for you, and I'm not sure that the TDC model would work within the seven county, given the existing multi-layer complexity that I for one would like to see streamlined significantly, if not take a layer away. And so I'd be willing to I'll get an answer, and you and I can talk. And I would be willing to focus this on the 80 counties that are not in the seven-county metro area, if appropriate.
Representative Kalin, since we heard from the other entities that didn't testify in division, would a representative from Met Council be in the room at this time? I don't see any. Oops, hold it. this could be. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Lisa Fernet. I'm with the Builders Association of Minnesota. Sorry, it's 8:30. I'm still getting used to moving quickly this morning. The Builders Association, first of all, appreciates Representative Kalin's willingness to work with us on the amendment that allowed for two-party agreements to keep going forward. We think that this is, although it's not necessary, it's another tool in the toolbox. We have several concerns that border along the lines of the questions that have been asked. First of all, I wanted to, I've done a lot of research on transfer development rights, and to my knowledge, all the banks that have been set up have been through local ordinances. It has not been a third-party entity or a non-governmental entity that has run any of these. There's five major ones in the United States. About 20 states have them set up loosely. Our concerns are with the third-party non-governmental entity that sets up the bank. How will the bank be set up? What sort of guidelines will be set up with it? Is there a brokerage fee or a markup fee, and what happens with that money? I've tried to find some information on what happens if there is a markup. I have not been able to find anything on that, but I would be willing to do some more research on that. What happens if there is a markup? Does the local government unit get a percentage back? Those things just tend to increase the price of land, which increases the price of the house, which exits people out of the market and makes it more difficult for them to purchase. There are some drawbacks that have come to my attention, including the fact that they're technically complicated and require significant investment of time and staff resources. So if it was a third-party non-governmental entity, again, the markup for that to pay those people to get them to move forward with the transfer development rights could be significant, raising the price of land. It's an unfamiliar concept to a lot of people, and there needs to be a lot of public education done on it. In research that I've done, it shows that people have gone to court suing over what they call eminent domain problems. And then the pace of the transaction depends on the private market for the development rights. So there's a lot of questions. It has worked in some states, but it has not been thoroughly accepted in a lot of areas.
I'm sorry, I did not get your name. Could you repeat?
Oh, I'm sorry, Lisa Fernet with the Builders Association of Minnesota.
All right, and did you testify in division?
I did, sir.
Thank you very much for doing that.
You're welcome.
Representative Del Valle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick clarification for Ms. Fernet.
Go ahead. I'm going to go back to Representative Biskins when you're finished.
I'm sorry. Okay, we'll make this quick. I heard you saying, I just wanted to confirm, this sounds intriguing to you, but you mentioned this is unnecessary?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gottwald, we consider it another tool in the toolbox. As many people have stated, there's already the options for people to go forward with this. Again, our concern, as far as the Builders Association of Minnesota was concerned, was that it would preclude any two-party contracts. Representative Kalin was kind enough to add an amendment for us that did not preclude those.
Representative Diskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One final question. This is to you, Mr. Chairman. I wasn't so concerned about this with the first motion, but now, knowing that it's going to another committee and knowing that shenanigans do indeed happen in different committees in the legislature, my concern is the real poison pills of the bill occur on lines 2.9 and 2.35, and that is with the word not after the word may. Mr. Chairman, if there was an amendment in a committee down the road to strip that word out, would it be your intention to recall this bill back to this committee for thorough vetting? Because this would be a hugely important issue that would belong within the purview of this committee, I would think.
Representative Kalin wishes to respond first. Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Biskins, I will not bring this bill forward if those two negatives that you refer to disappear.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Biskins, in this case, I'll support Representative Kalin.
The earth is shaking beneath us, Mr. Chair.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing no one else, Representative Kalin?
Mr. Chair, I renew my motion.
President Kalin renews his motion that House File 305 be passed and be re-referred to the Commerce Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Representative Nelson, you have another motion for us? On House File 644,
I'd like to move House File 644 and
Representative Nelson moves the adoption of the division report on House File 644.
Yes.
Any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Representative Nelson, do you have another motion for us?
There's an amendment. There was some confusion, and I guess this amendment came between...
Representative Nelson, I believe at this point we're going to have to move the bill.
Move the bill, okay.
And the bill is the bill engrossed or isn't it? No, it is not. So we've got House File 644. Representative Nelson, why don't you move House File 644? And
I'd like to move
where
House
is this bill to go from here?
And that's the question I had. I was looking at.
It's my understanding.
Representative Champion, where do you wish this bill to go from here?
It's my understanding that it goes to workforce. That's my understanding.
Representative Nelson, is that the understanding that was in division? That this would go to workforce development?
Yeah, I understand he had in division, excuse me, was that it was come to here. I didn't. This would probably have to go to workforce development, labor, and
higher education.
Labor and consumer affairs, I was thinking, but
labor can. All right, which one is it? Which one is it going to go to? Let's settle that first. Either the author or the chair of the division.
I guess I'm looking for guidance from the.
Workforce development.
Thank you.
So, Representative Nelson moves that House File 644 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Workforce Development. Representative Champion, two-year bill, and I believe you have an amendment to your bill.
That's right.
That you wish to have put on it. So, I'm going to go with Representative Nelson. You want to move?
I'd like to move the amendment 644A1.
H-O-644A1. Representative Nelson moves 644A1, and why don't we put that on the bill and get the bill in shape. So all those in favor of 644A1 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Representative Champion, your bill is now amended, and it's ready to go. So why don't you speak to the bill and to the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I would like the committee to know that on the division level, we had an opportunity to have testimony from, at least in attendance also, was Jim Frisco. He's with the National Association of Minority Contractors. Mr. Roosevelt Gaines, who is also with the Minneapolis Urban League. Reverend Jerry McAfee, a community person. And also we had mutual testimony from Elizabeth Campbell with Ryan Companies, who is still here with us today. This particular bill, I think, is an opportunity for us to give an additional tool to cities and or home rule charters to be able to use this tool in order to have as a part of public funds or contracts that do for developments and service contracts or even, you know, projects to be able to have as a requirement for there to be a city residential requirement or low-income requirement. We believe that this is important in order to hire, also to stabilize economies, to support local residents, and it also gives the cities, as I mentioned earlier, flexibility. When we think in terms of this particular bill, we're not saying to any particular city, one, that they have to do it, because this is an enabling statute. Number two, we're also saying to them, you have flexibility to design something that fits your area in order to empower you. We did receive some questions on the division level around whether this could be achieved without this law. My answer to that question is no. Cities currently do not have this authority in statute. Some larger cities work with developers, for example, or on major projects to achieve the same outcomes on an ad hoc, project-by-project basis. And we also have with us Craig Johnson, who's with the League of Minnesota Cities. We did receive word from the League of Minnesota Cities that they are they are in support of neutral. They don't believe it's a problem because it's permissive. It's also our understanding that they advise now if cities want to develop contracts that have this residential requirement and or low income, they advise cities now not to because they don't have the statutory authority or they're uncertain. They believe, and Ms. Johnson can speak to this, but they believe that this bill would grant them the authority that they need as a tool if a city so wanted to do so. So we are asking for this particular committee to pass this bill on. I would also like to bring forward, not to duplicate a testimony earlier, but to create some context of how such a bill could be utilized on a day-to-day basis by a city that could lead down to a prime that would support residents. So I'm going to ask Elizabeth Campbell.
Before you do that, mm-hmm. I'm reminded of our interesting committee structure. And I'm going to ask Representative Nelson to withdraw his motion and then to restate his motion. It has to go to finance first to get to workforce development. We just can't send what it must go in through the portal of finance.
And I'll restate my motion for the bill to pass and be referred to finance.
So Representative Nelson withdraws his motion, and then the motion is to recommend that House File 644 be recommended to pass and be referred to finance with the recommendation that it be sent to workforce development. That's the proper motion before us. All right. And now, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Elizabeth Campbell, in Emerging Inclusion Coordinator for Ryan Company.
Ms. Campbell.
Yes. Okay. I'm here to speak today about the resident hiring goal in practice on two projects, one in the city of Minneapolis, the Midtown Exchange Project, and the other in the city of St. Paul. On the Midtown Exchange Project, there was a resident hiring goal tied to zip codes contiguous to the project. That project, some of you may know, is at Chicago and Lake, one of the more economically depressed neighborhoods in Minneapolis. And the goal was 25 to 30 residents, and 45 hires were made. Ryan is a union general contractor, so the development agreement stipulated that these resident hires would be unemployed trade workers. And so all 45 hires were trade workers or trainees with union cards. Four of those were trainees with union cards. In the city of St. Paul, it was a Super Target Midway project, again, a high visibility urban project. No public money. 8 to 10 resident hire goal and 26 actual hires. Again, all of those hires were trade union workers.
Members, any questions? Thank you. Any questions for the bill? Representative Gutwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Champion, this is your first bill, right?
That's right.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Congratulations. So much. I just have a couple of questions. For one, as I'm looking through the amendment, which is now really the bill, we don't have a definition of low income, which I think is one issue. Is that something you intend to or you're proposing putting in at some point?
Representative Chandler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. We intentionally did not put a definition of low income into the bill because we wanted to make sure cities had the flexibility and the opportunity to define it and use criteria that they believe to be important for them. And so, again, this is an enabling statute, so it's permissive. So this is not a mandate. So we want to give them guiding principles and support the whole notion of inclusion. And so that's why we believe that this particular bill was crafted the way it is.
President Gummel.
Thank you.
Oh, and wait a second. Maybe the testifier wishes to respond.
Chair and Representative, in the city of St. Paul, identified, I mentioned in Midtown Exchange they were contiguous zip codes. In the city of St. Paul, they identified zip codes of low income throughout the city. So this would give in practice, the cities are able to identify.
Representative Gutwell, another question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up. I'm still not understanding that this isn't something cities can already do. I'm thinking back over my history again, and I'm not aware that there's anything that prevents a city from doing anything like this if they choose to right now. I realize this puts actual statutory language to that, but I'm personally a little reticent to see more language put in law just for the sake of stating it there, when in fact cities already have the flexibility to do this.
Representative Chanting, you want to respond to that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, as I articulated earlier, the cities do not all have the ability or the authority to craft such an ordinance and make some of these requirements a part of that ordinance. That was something that we did talk to the League of Minnesota Cities about, and as I indicated, Mr. Johnson and others are here, and they're pretty neutral, but they believe that this may be another tool. I did also talk to the City of Minneapolis, who, you know, would say we'd run it up our chain in order to make sure that we cover all the legal bases. So right now, there's uncertainty about it, and there is no authority, but they see this as an opportunity to grant them the authority to work with their residents and their area to come up with an ordinance that would be beneficial and impactful for all of their residents.
Representative
Gumbel. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Champion, I think in development agreements, cities certainly can specify some of these things. You mentioned earlier on a case-by-case basis. So while they may not be able to create an ordinance, they can certainly choose to do this on a development-by-development basis. I'm not aware of anything, unless someone else has testimony to the contrary, that prevents a city in a development agreement from doing this kind of thing.
Representative Channing?
Mr. Chair, Representative, as I indicated earlier, that there's been some ad hoc project-by-project agreements between cities and developers, but some cities have not gone that far because of the uncertainty and feeling as if they do not have the authority or the support by which to do so. And we don't want that just to be the order of the day when we think in terms of development agreements. We want them to have clear authority and for them to craft an ordinance that would be beneficial for them and their residents in a way so that they're not feeling like they're uncertain. We want certainty to be the order of the day. And again, this particular bill provides that clarity and also flexibility. And we believe that is good for the state of Minnesota.
First Amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Champion, I suppose for the chair first, I'm a little concerned because I thought the idea was when they go to division, you flesh out all these issues before they get here, and these are not the same bills at all. I mean, the amended language is completely different, and I'm interested to know, is this the way... is there a reason why this didn't go back through the division, Mr. Chair, in terms of this new language?
Representative Emmer, I had this discussion with Representative Champion, and believe me, I'm not pleased either that we're amending a division bill significantly in this committee. So I am glad a member of the committee has raised the issue, and as we've already seen, we have had, I'll call it a shakedown cruise with the division beneath us. But it is my understanding that a division should complete this work and then send the bill up to us. So I'm glad you raised the issue, Representative Emmer.
May I speak to that question?
Representative Champion.
There's a couple things that I want to mention. Number one, it's unfortunate that we use the word shakedown. But number two, what I think is clear here is that we didn't try to do anything that would be an undermining of any division work or the work of this wonderful committee here. One is there's nothing different in this legislation from the division until now. What we did, in fact, was just to clarify some of the concerns that were raised by the division. One thing that the division did say is that if in any amendments that there was a change and it no longer became permissive, that they wanted it to come back to them at that particular time. In fact, that was something that Representative Diskin raised. There's nothing that changes this enabling statute. There's nothing that changes the principles that were articulated earlier. And there's very few changes when we think in terms of the language of this particular amendment. One thing that we did add that was important to add was simply the language that says, for an example, that this particular language, that this particular statute would not pertain to city hires. And we just wanted that to be clear, because the way it was drafted before, there could be that assumption that it would have far-reaching effects over into that pool of employees. So I would hope that this particular committee would, you know, act affirmatively on this bill and not send it back to the division. But if the chair and others so believe that to be necessary, then I would ask you this, because it's important to me that cities receive this tool and for there not to be any barriers to them having the opportunity to positively impact their residents and their community.
Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Champion, while I appreciate that as a member of the minority and after the discussions we've had over the last couple of weeks on the House floor about how debate can be limited, the only opportunity that our members get in some cases is through the committee process. And while I can appreciate your good faith intentions to move this forward in your beliefs that it's necessary, the statement that you have addressed the concerns raised at the division, and that's what we're faced with today, well, that's fine. That doesn't give those people that might have raised the questions at the division any ability to ensure that their input is as they had requested. That's my only concern. I won't be making that motion. Representative Champion, I won't do that to you at all, because I understand that there are time constraints and you're moving it through the process. I do want to ask you a couple of questions. First off, and I appreciate you clarifying again that this has been done on an ad hoc basis project. By the way, I'd suggest to you do have some significant changes in here, one of which is you've carved out any union employee from being subject to this rule. It doesn't apply to contracts between the city and an exclusive representative of city employees. That I think is a significant change, and I'm sure that there were people at the division that might like to have addressed that. But be that as it may, my question, the first one has to do this project-by-project basis. You told us in response to Representative Gottwald that you're trying to clear up the uncertainty. Well, the question I have, and then I have a follow-up on a constitutional issue, is of these contracts that have been done on an ad hoc basis, Representative Champion, have any of those agreements been challenged on a legal basis that they're somehow unfair or discriminatory?
Representative Champion.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't have any information that would allow me to speak directly to that, but as I sit here before you, I can't think of any at this particular time. But that is not to suggest that there hasn't been any challenges or any notions of uncertainty.
Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Champion, I guess I'm interested in what we do know rather than what we might assume or expect. Is it your understanding then, based on what you do know, that these agreements that have been handled on an ad hoc basis have been working, at least with those parties?
Representative Chan.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's my understanding that that they've been working to some degree, but there's been some folks, for an example, who want to do something as so eloquently, I hope eloquently, articulated in our bill, that was uncertain about wanting to go forward or do anything that would require sort of a local resident goal or low-income goal because of the uncertainty. So that's what I do know, is that there's uncertainty in the marketplace with cities, and therefore this is another tool that they could use if they so desired and chose.
Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Champion, again, I think your intent is well-founded, and what you're trying to do I think is appropriate, but I don't know that it works in a law, and maybe somebody else in the committee has experience with it, or you do personally. I'm concerned that what you're potentially creating is you don't have challenges to existing agreements ad hoc agreements on project by project, but you're going to enact a law that if it's utilized, I'm afraid that you're going to create the basis for a constitutional challenge. Because if I recall right, there are cases already, equal protection cases, that cities can't base their hiring practices on your residence, where you're located. In other words, you can't be chosen over another qualified candidate just because you live within the city boundaries, unless, of course, it might apply to some special service like a firefighter or something that has to do with a safety, health and safety issue. By enacting this, and I see that you've changed the language to take out words like hiring, you know, words that might more directly impact that constitutional, potential constitutional challenge. Aren't you a little concerned that by enacting this, as you call it, tool, that you might suggest, or you might subject cities like Minneapolis, St. Paul, and others to litigation?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Champion.
Let me respond to this, to that question in this way. One, I believe that we are creating the opportunity for cities to have a tool. That tool leads to them having the opportunity to craft language that they believe to be appropriate and acceptable. As so eloquently articulated by the city of Minneapolis, for example, what they would do if they wanted to enact such an ordinance, they would run it through their city attorney's office. They would make sure that their legal beagles, for lack of a better word, have an opportunity to look at the information and to make an informed and learned decision as to what they should or should not do. When we think in terms of opportunity, there's flexibility. Flexibility so that it can be crafted, ordinances can be crafted for different places and spaces, because we all have different and various needs. And so I believe that the flexibility and opportunity creates ownership and empowerment. Empowerment is the order of the day here, in order for all cities to have tools and opportunities to positively impact their communities. And I believe that this is such a tool.
Representative Merle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I take with great respect the observations that Representative Gottwald offered earlier. I'm sorry, I'm going back to that previous point. Mr. Chair, I was hoping we might hear from the League of Minnesota Cities about the counsel they've been giving cities regarding the uncertainty that they face.
Are they still here?
Yep. I believe Mr. Johnson is still here.
All right. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair members. My name is Ann Finn. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities. And
before you start, did you testify in division on the bill?
I personally did not.
Did the league
believe we had someone there.
But the league did testify in division.
They did not testify, but we have received some information from them, but they didn't testify at that particular time.
And you testified to the bill as it existed before we adopted the amendment. So you're testifying now to the bill as amended.
Correct.
All right. Thank you. Proceed.
And, Mr. Chair members, I believe the question was in regards to how we advise cities currently. And I'm not sure that I can answer that. I'm not an attorney, but I understand that our lead counsel, Tom Grundhofer, did speak yesterday with Ms. Dyson. And I think under current law, there probably is a little discomfort with whether or not this authority exists explicitly. And that's what we would tell our members.
Representative Merle, does that answer you?
I'll defer to, I think Representative Gottwald wanted to follow up maybe on this point of certainty or uncertainty.
Okay, Representative Gottwald, why don't you go?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Merle, you're correct. To the testifier, do we need this? Is this something that cities see that they need as a tool in order to do anything like this? Has this need come forth from the cities? Have they expressed concern about, as Representative Champion has indicated, uncertainty or unclarity about what they can or can't do in this regard? Is this something the cities need?
Ms. Finn.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gottwald, we've not heard a cry for this. However, I think if there is a renewed interest, given that Representative Champion has brought this issue forward, there may be some interest coming from folks, and obviously he's hearing this from his community, which might give folks comfort if they do want to implement a policy or an ordinance like this.
Representative Gutlaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to be clear, there doesn't appear to be any prohibition right now. There's just desire that maybe this language would give them a little more encouragement.
Ms. Finn.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gottwald, I think that's accurate.
Representative Murray, you want to continue with your questioning?
Mr. Chair, if I might, just to be clear, there's a few terms being put out, a need, a concern. There also is a difference between seeds being prohibited from doing something and seeds being expressly authorized to do something. And I think that what this ordinance would do is this bill would do is expressly authorize cities to do that which they're uncertain. At least some cities are uncertain whether they have the express authority to do. Do I have that correct?
Ms. Finn?
Mr. Chair and Representative Morrow, that is correct.
Representative Murrow, is that finished for your question? Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, this the division process fell through on a couple of fronts. One is with the main amendment in the first place. The amendment, as Representative Champion said, came forward due to concerns that were brought out in division. However, I will state emphatically, to my knowledge, there was absolutely no discussion in division about the sentence that was added on lines 1.13 and 1.14. Right? So I think there's a little misstatement here that this amendment addresses what happened in division. I will also say, Mr. Chair, in division we had quite a discussion about the need for this bill, and now I'm finding out that it's based on inaccurate testimony that was given in division, because in division we were told that this was something they could already do. And we spent quite a bit of time talking about why we should be putting in language into law that they could already do. Now we're finding out that, well, maybe they can, maybe they can't, and that's a substantial difference. Because now we're not talking in division about passing unnecessary language. Now we are talking about creating in state law the ability for subunits of government to create quotas in some fashion. Right. This is quotas based on where people live and some mysterious definition of low income. And that's a huge difference. That's a huge difference when we're talking about state law. Had I have known that that's what we were doing in division, I would have been much more emphatic about my objections to this bill. I know now, and so I'm going to emphatically state my objections. Thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My concern on this particular bill is the fact that there's an exemption. If this is good, why exempt unions? I mean, a matter of fact, it seems like the whole premise of a union might be that this would fit very well. So what would be the justification to exempt a certain grouping of employees?
Representative Champion, you wish to answer that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. I'm going to address this two ways. One, I want to address the amendment itself. Representative Biskins asked at the division that if this particular legislation no longer became an enabling statute, would it be required for it to come back to the division? That was discussed. Everyone said that if it ceased being an enabling statute or permissive, then it would go back to the division. It is still permissive. Number two, when we think in terms of the notion of quotas, that sends in my mind sort of a negative connotation. This is an opportunity not just for low income. If you look in the statute, it says city residents or low income. That's an important conjunction, because it doesn't mean that they have to be a city resident and low income. It gives cities the opportunity and the authority to design an ordinance or law that would be beneficial to them. The other question that was so eloquently put forward by Representative Kiffmeyer is around why did we take out this whole notion of union or exempt them out? This particular statute was really intended around developments and professional services, not cities who have ongoing employment obligations with any particular person or union. That was not the intent of this particular statute. And so that's why we wanted to make sure that that was clear, that we were not overreaching into that area or pool, but to be very clear about who or what we were talking about. That's why at the top here, it talks about require city contract for construction or services. And so we believe that this further clarifies, so we're real clear as to who this particular ordinance could potentially cover if a city so chose to use it as a tool to design an ordinance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Champion. I appreciate that explanation, but I think no matter what you call it, opportunity, that's the first time I've kind of heard the definition that way of an opportunity, because I still think it's a quota no matter what. It's a requirement of a minimum, and I do think that this should apply equally to everyone and not exempt them. It's just, we may disagree on that, but I appreciate your explanation, but I just think that equalness means everybody should be able to apply and not have that. It's in the best interest of your contracts and services, and then exempting people just kind of negates the whole point of making sure that this is equally applied. So I just have a couple questions, and certainly with the history of quotas, whether it's a definition or not, I think people will see through that kind of a thing, and they may take the opportunity to challenge it on that basis of what's really happening, not on what you call it.
Representative Champion. Mr. Chair, Representative, here's the bottom line. Cities could look at this and say, we don't want to design any ordinance at all. They have that flexibility. There's nothing in this legislation that's being proposed that says a city is mandated to do anything. Secondly, I think you're absolutely right that we do all have our different ways of perceiving things. I perceive it as an opportunity. I also perceive it as good public policy that we look to improve the quality of life of all people and find creative ways by which to do that, because that's good public policy, not to the exclusion of anyone, but it is a notion to foster inclusion, and I believe that's what we're doing, is fostering inclusion by giving cities the tools and opportunities to decide, which I think is a wonderful thing for folks to have the opportunity to decide and make a choice.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I have another question. That in regards to the stimulus bill, I know there's a lot of unknowns in that stimulus bill. There's a lot of requirements that have come with that. So I have a concern that we got a lot of stuff coming down here, and now we're adding something, and my concern is that when you got a huge amount of changes that every bill was going to be affected by these big federal process coming down the line, what's this going to do to language like this, in addition to all of the language of the stimulus bill that's coming from the federal government, lots and lots of strings and ties and requirements and things like that? So I'm looking at this saying, is this the time to do it?
Is that a question, Representative Kiffmeyer, or is that just a rhetorical statement?
Well, it was a bit of a question, if anybody chooses to respond to it, certainly.
You wish me to respond? I learned today that apparently the toolbox of the local units of government is amazingly large, considering the number of tools we're putting in it. And I assume it could accommodate those federal tools, too. I don't know if that answers the question, but apparently, they must have. Representative Champion, you want to respond to that? Because I do have a couple more people on the list.
Yes.
Representative Champion.
Mr. Chair, Representative, first of all, I don't believe the cities would do anything that would compromise, or nor would we do anything to compromise the stimulus bill or the Recovery Act. Number two, Representative Kiffmeyer talks about mandates, and there's nothing about this legislation that mandates anyone to do anything. In fact, if you look at line 1.5, it says may adopt. So there's nothing that says shall adopt. And I think that's important when we think in terms of mandates, because that's not a directive directing cities to do anything. But again, adding another tool to that large toolbox, but I just believe that it's important for us to have, and it's good public policy.
Incredibly large toolbox. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to offer helpful I hope, suggestion for Representative Diskins, which is in our division discussion, I know that it was, I guess, so clear to me that you thought that the bill had no practical effect or legal effect. The basic premise of local government is that they only have the power and authority that the state government gives them, much like the federal government only has the power and authority the Constitution gives it. And I don't think that there was a discussion with House staff to clarify that that was the case, that this had no practical effect. And so I think that it was at least clear to some degree that this is an enabling piece of legislation. That's how it was presented. I don't think that there was any inaccurate testimony presented by Representative Champion to that regard.
Representative Emmer. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess, Ms. Finn, if that's all right, you testified that you're not a lawyer, but can you tell us, do you know from Mr. Grundhoffer or someone else over at the League as to whether or not a requirement in a city contract for construction or services, a requirement like the one that this would authorize, would be illegal? You know.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I don't know for certain. That said, I may drag up Mr. Ranieri, because I think the city of Minneapolis perhaps has some experience with contracts that have some level of requirements in it. So I'll ask him to perhaps comment about what the city of Minneapolis has done.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Gene Ranieri. I am the IGR director for the city of Minneapolis. The city of Minneapolis, as part of its working on the redevelopment and development projects, has often put in worked in contracts and agreements with developers to have agreements where a certain percent of folks would be from neighborhoods or from certain income levels. And an example would be Midtown Exchange, the old Sears building, where I think Ryan worked with us on that. There are other projects we do the same thing. In that case, we've had pretty good success, particularly with Midtown Exchange. I think we're very close to making the goal there of requiring folks from hiring folks from the neighborhood.
Mr. Ranieri, did you testify in the division?
Mr. Chairman, I did not.
Did you contact the author as to the bill in its original form, whether you supported it or not?
Mr. Chairman, I did not.
You supported it in its current form.
Mr. Chair, the city may act as neutral on this topic. We are looking at it from aspects to possibly come back and give a position, but right now we're neutral.
Mr. Ranieri, in the form that it is in, can you implement it?
Mr. Chairman, it's a very good question. Not being an attorney, I don't know. I can't answer that right now.
Representative Emmer?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Ranieri, what do you do for the city of Minneapolis?
I'm the Intergovernmental Relations Director for the city of Minneapolis.
All right. And I guess I appreciate the testimony, because I wrote down your involvement would be either as a participant or an advisor or an observer in your capacity of an RFP issued by the city of Minneapolis. And then as part of that RFP, there would be certain expectations as to who the approved or selected vendor would be contracting with in order to complete the service or construction that's designated. But here we're talking about something different, and I take it that you don't have... I'm going to give you an example. How's this? This proposal in its current form says construction or services. Do you know if it would be legal for the city of Minneapolis to enact under this ordinance that would say that anyone providing is a ice cream vendor in the city of Minneapolis that is under contract with the city of Minneapolis must have their business located within the city of Minneapolis? Would that be legal?
Mr. Ranieri?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Emmer, not being an attorney, I can't give you a definitive answer, but in looking at this, it is permissive to the city. I would assume we would have a legal analysis telling us what we can do with our ordinance. We would draft it. our city attorney would review it and give advice to the city council on what they can and cannot do.
Right. Mr. Chair, here's the problem that I have. This is a policy committee, and I know I just asked a question that's more appropriate for a civil justice committee, but here's the issue, is that I don't think that this policy committee should be in the habit of passing proposed legislation that would authorize local units of government to enact illegal requirements, or I know Representative Champion doesn't like this, or mandate, because that's exactly what this would provide for and what I'm concerned with, and maybe I'm completely wrong, but this is why, you know, I complained at the outset about the process, Representative Champion. I don't mean to frustrate what you're trying to do, which, again, I think it has merit, but I think you're going to run into problems if you enact something like this. Great, you put something on the books, but they can't enact legislation that would create a constitutional challenge, ultimately, and it seems to be working on an ad hoc private basis between private entities. As soon as the government starts to get involved in saying only people within these boundaries, only people of these certain are going to be allowed to work these projects, I think you open up a whole litigation can of worms in this. That's my statement. I have problems with it.
We're getting down to the last 10 minutes. Representative Anderson, you were on the list, and then you indicated, if you want to ask a question, go ahead.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. And it was addressed by Representative Ammer. It seems as though it's working to the degree and extent that it's working. I don't know, but the process is working to a degree. And if there have been no problems in terms of legal challenges to the ad hoc instances that has been done, I would agree that let's let well enough alone. Let it work in the private way that it has been working in the past. Just my comment.
Mr. Chair? Wait, hold it. I've got a list. Representative Gutwell, you were on the list. You're fine. Representative Biscuit.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, if I could ask Mr. Ranieri a question.
Mr. Ranieri, come back up, please.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ranieri, I think the key difference, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that this bill would allow cities to actually adopt an ordinance. And my question to you, Mr. Ranieri, does Minneapolis have an ordinance which allows them to create these quota contracts?
Mr. Ranieri.
Mr. Chair, I have that question, and my understanding we do not at this time have one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Morrow.
Mr. Chair, very briefly, I just want to stay again with Representative's idea of staying within the purview of the committee. My take on it is a little bit different. Certainly the city of Minneapolis may be already entering these contracts, but we also heard that there's some concerns of other cities that they're not taking this step or may not be taking this step because they fear they are not expressly authorized under statute right now. So it's a little hard to prove a negative. Cities not being challenged, well, they may not even be entering these contracts or enacting these types of provisions because they're afraid they are not expressly authorized.
Right. Do we have anybody else who wishes to testify on the bill as amended? Is there any other local government entity that wishes that we have somebody else? No? Hold it. Do we have someone who's taking off their coat?
He's got a lawyer.
Is there? Here we go. Welcome to the committee and to the amendment, and please identify yourself for the record. You have about 5 minutes.
Chair, my name is Tom Grundhofer, General Counsel with the League of Cities.
Mr. Grundhofer, have you seen the amendment?
And yes.
I mean, seen it as if you understand it, not that you've looked at it.
No, I did look at it yesterday.
All right. So can you tell us where is the League of Cities on the amended bill?
You know, I don't think the League of Cities has a particular point of view on this amendment. I guess I would take the position that we would always, you know, like to have greater local authority, but we're certainly not a position that we've advocated on.
Representative Gumball.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Knopfer, for running over here so quickly. The specific question, and we really haven't had a clear answer to it yet on this bill and this amended version, is it currently illegal Is there anything preventing your member cities from doing these kinds of things on their own with contracts or development agreements? Is it illegal? Because we've heard there's concern among some cities, some lack of clarity, which is usually resolved by checking with your city attorney.
Right.
But Mr. Brenda.
Mr. Chair, you can't find any place in the statutes that prohibits, for instance, giving a local preference or awarding a contract based on economic conditions of a contractor. At least with regard to local preference, though, we've taken the view that both from a constitutional standpoint, both state and federal constitution, that we can't give or arguably give local preferences under the current competitive bidding procedures. That's our view.
All right. Further questions? Any further testimony on the bill as amended? No further testimony. Representative Nelson's motion is to pass House File 644 as amended and refer it to where to the Finance Committee because it with the recommendation that it go to Workforce Development. And Representative Champion, I hope you have listened very closely to what happens when what in effect is a delete everything amendment to a bill, and we have to scramble to try to understand it in committee. So Representative Champion, I hope you've learned a lesson here today.
May I speak, Mr. Chair?
I would hope you would.
I will say this. One that I've learned, this is a learning process for me, and I know that different chairs like to do things differently, and I like to make sure, and I will make sure, that we do not have amendments brought before the entire committee, and that divisions are there for a reason, and that there's work that would and must be done on that particular level in order to make sure once it comes to this level, we are not having this discussion, but we're having a livelier discussion about something else. So
I'll note it. Representative Nelson renews his motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, nay.
No.
Chair is in doubt. All those signify by raising your hands.
In favor.
All those opposed. There being 10 ayes and 6 nays, the motion prevails. President Poppy, you have a motion for it.
So move the minutes of Thursday, February 12, 2009.
Any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Members, we have referred 2 bills to division, and we have a number of bills up tomorrow morning dealing with elections. With that, meeting is adjourned.